Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. You might have this image in your head of a writer as a person who completely withdraws from the world for a couple of years and recreates a whole new world in a little room somewhere. Well, that's actually true for my guest today. Well, partly true anyway. His name is Nadeem Aslam. Nadeem Aslam's novels have won many prizes all over the world, and he's now regarded as a major international author. Nadeem was born in Pakistan and he emigrated to the UK with his parents when he was just a teenager. He was studying biochemistry, but he gave it away to become a writer. His second novel, which was called Maps for Lost Lovers, took 11 years to write, and he wrote it cloistered from the world, living on very little money. Nadeem Aslam's newest novel is called The Wasted Vigil, and it's his portrait of Afghanistan, and he manages within this novel to encompass all of its sadness, its surprising beauty, and its violence as well. Nadeem Aslam, good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
I loved reading this book. It's beautiful. It's exquisite. I read somewhere that you say, with an earlier novel, it was your intention to write it like a beautiful Persian miniature, like one of those miniature portraits where every little detail is exquisitely put out. Obviously, there's elements of that in this novel too, Nadeem.
Absolutely. I wanted to write about Afghanistan first and foremost because I thought it had been forgotten. And this sounds like a strange statement because Afghanistan is in the news every day. How can it have been forgotten? But it's in the news every day for what it is doing to the rest of the world, in that so many Australian troops are in danger there, so many American troops have been killed, so many NATO troops have been injured and killed there. But what the world did to Afghanistan over the past 30 years seems to be a mystery to most people, seems to come as news. So I just wanted to bring the world's attention to that.
Well, Afghanistan seems quite mysterious to the rest of the world. It's why people are doing what they're doing seems mysterious to many other people as
I
well.
I think it does indeed, but it's mysterious because of the way the world is structured. It wasn't mysterious back in 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded and the West and America primarily decided that they would use this opportunity to try to give the Soviet Union a bloody nose, as it were.
And
billions of dollars worth of weapons were poured into Afghanistan via Pakistan. And there were people back then in the West, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan itself, who were saying that this is a short-sighted policy. What do you think is going to happen to these lovely shiny weapons once the Soviets have left? What do you think is going to happen to this jihadi mindset which is being created? And this sounds like this again comes as news to most people that the intelligence agencies of Western countries would revisit Muslim countries back in the 1980s and would talk to young men and would use this word, which is now a dirty word, jihad. They would say it is your religious duty to go into Pakistan and then cross over into Afghanistan and fight the Soviets there. So they actually were bringing in these young men. So
jihad was used by Western intelligence agencies at the time to get local people to fight against the Soviet Union.
Not just local, just throughout the Muslim world. I mean, there is a sequence in the novel which I did not make up, which is there is a very important tunnel in the north of Kabul called the Salang Tunnel. And it was a very important supply route for the Soviet troops. So it had to be somehow destroyed. But because it was important, it was very well guarded. You could not pack a van with explosives, take it in there, and just walk out because the Soviets would immediately come to investigate. So the only way to destroy it was to get a suicide bomber. The CIA actually suggested to the Afghanis and those jihadis and the mujahideens that we need a suicide bomber to actually go and destroy their to destroy the tunnel, and the Muslims were appalled at the thought that because suicide is a sin.
So really what you're writing about then, and one of the things you're writing about in your book is the way a kind of a poor country like Afghanistan, it can be used, I suppose, as the proxy
absolutely.
For someone else.
Absolutely, yes.
And you point this as the case of jihadists even today. They're the proxies of some very cynical older men in the Taliban. And
indeed,
the like.
Absolutely. That is the case. And for example, my character, my jihadi character in The Wasted Vigil is a young man called Qasa, and who grew up in the orphanages, ended up in the madrasas, and then ended up in the terrorist training camps. He thinks very objectionable things, and he thinks and does very objectionable things. But readers keep coming up to me after my readings, and I keep getting letters from readers. They're saying that they have every sympathy for him. They just hate his handlers. They have contempt for the people who have brainwashed him and have taught him that this is the only way for a Muslim to make a mark in the world, as it were, to have his voice heard. But for the boy himself, I was actually quite anxious when I was making him up. I was quite anxious.
Anxious? Why?
Well, because I thought he thinks, as I just said, very objectionable things. So his ideas about women, his ideas about non-Muslims.
So you have to transplant your own imagination into that character.
Absolutely. Mm. But then, of course, there's partly its imagination and partly its research. In Pakistan, when I visited Pakistan and I went to Afghanistan, I realized very soon after getting there that I was never more than two people away from someone who had been to a jihadi training camp. And that is still true. The last time I visited Pakistan, I would be talking to someone on the bus. And the boy, after our conversation had gone on for about 5 or 10 minutes, and I would express my interest in the jihadi training camps because I'm writing about these subjects, he would grin and say, you know, I went to one of those. And one thing you have to understand is that these boys that I met, they kept saying to me again and again that I would ask them, why did you go? Why did you train? Why do you hold these beliefs? They kept saying again and again, because our brothers are suffering in Kashmir, our brothers are suffering in Palestine. Now, as I said, what is wrong is that somebody has told them that the only way to stop, to end the suffering of the people in Kashmir and to end the suffering of people in Palestine is for you to strap a suicide bomb on a belt onto your waist and go and explode yourself somewhere in the market. This boy who is 16 or 17, I don't remember being very smart at 16 or 17, you know. So there is that. And there is, of course, the human element. In The Wasted Vigil, there, as I said, there is this character called Qasa. And he says at one point, and someone actually told me this, that until he was about 13, he had never seen a woman because women's faces were not allowed.
Not anyway, his mother?
No, well, because he was an orphan. He grew up in the orphanages. He had never seen a woman. And this sounds like an astonishing statement for him to have made. And he said that, I learned that in this madrasa, a group of boys had a picture of a woman's face which they had cut out of a magazine and then divided into smaller sections for safekeeping because the teachers at the madrasa would not allow them to have a woman's face. So one boy would keep an eye, the other boy would keep the second eye, one boy would keep the lips, the chin, and once a month this jigsaw would be at night, this jigsaw would be brought together and they would have this woman viewing moment. And he said, I begged them to let me see this creature called female, woman. And eventually they actually agreed. And he says that the first time I saw it, I couldn't breathe and I fainted. That she was so beautiful. I didn't realize that the world was capable of this kind of beauty. And of course, this is in a novel. And Qasa says, and someone said that to me, he said that the world has nothing to offer me except cruelty and danger. This is a boy who, as a child, has been raped, who has been beaten, who, you know, and who, as a young teenager, has raped others and beaten others. What do you expect these people to be like, you know?
Nadeem, let's talk about how you're going into Afghanistan and and Pakistan. I wonder what that was like for you as a guy who's mostly been living in the UK for I suppose, the larger part of
two decades, now, absolutely.
2 decades. So what was that like for you? Afghanistan's a pretty scary place to go into for anyone. And to go in there for you, what did you try and do? Did you try and make yourself appear to be Afghani? Or were you able to do that?
Well, first of all, I'm quite obsessive when it comes to my writing. So people say that it's quite a dangerous place. Why did you go? I wasn't really thinking of anything except my novel. So, but before going there, I wanted to... I'm a writer, but I'm also a human being. So I said to myself that I will write the first draft of The Wasted Vigil in England, in that I want to learn something about myself, in that am I the kind of human being who makes assumptions about another culture, who thinks the Afghanis would behave that way, etc., etc. Let me put this story together with that frame of mind, and then I would go, and then I would make corrections if corrections needed to be made. So I wrote the first draft, I printed it out, put it into my rucksack, and then I went. I would wander around Kabul during the day, Jalalabad, Herat. And at the end of the day...
Sorry, dressed as what? Dressed as a local?
No, yes, dressed absolutely. As a Westerner? Dressed as a... In kameez shalwar, I stopped shaving, and I had a bit of stubble. But the thing is that a foreigner... Because a culture knows who does not belong. For example, I would be standing outside a roadside cafe with my interpreter and my driver, who would be driving me from place to place. And the little beggar boys would come and they would ask me for money. They would never ask them for money. And I asked my interpreter, how do they know I'm a foreigner? I'm dressed exactly like you. My skin color is like yours. How do they know? And they said, because you're wearing your shoulder bag across your chest. He says, Westerners wear it like this. We actually hang it on one shoulder. So there are tiny things which actually... let people know.
And how about language? Language is different in Afghanistan from...
Indeed.
Isn't it?
Urdu, yeah. Absolutely. It's Pashto. But as I said, I had an interpreter. So I talked to everyone. I talked to those little beggar boys. I talked to the man who sold me tea and my morning bread. I talked to the hotel owner. I talked to professors. I talked to economists. I talked to the woman who sold me my ticket to fly from Kabul to Herat, because I said I wanted to find out what the texture of the thought was in that country. And also, I'm the kind of writer who wishes to know certain things about certain physical things, in that if I'm setting a sequence in March, let's say, in Afghanistan, in Kabul, I need to know what does the sky look like in March. In Kabul, is it blue? Is it gray? How many clouds are there? Which trees are in flower? Which birds are singing in the trees?
And this is stuff you can't pick up on the web, is
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yes. So one needs to do that. There are writers who make up these things, use other sources. But I like to know these things. For example, I live in England. And my last novel, Maps for Lost Lovers, was set in England. But even in England, I can't really have two people in a garden talking in the month of March and say that a dragonfly went by, because dragonflies don't appear in England until April, if you know what I'm saying.
And this is what you're like as a writer. My guest this morning in conversation is the author Nadeem Aslam, the author of a novel, The Wasted Vigil. Your books remind me of like those beautiful, exquisite paintings from, I don't know, the Flemish paintings from the Northern Renaissance, where every leaf is painted on the tree.
That's right.
Every golden thread is painted on someone's cloak. It's like that. Those kinds of details give it a kind of hyper-real vividness. Do you need to be shocking yourself in a way to see that, to go to a place that's like Afghanistan, where everything is so radically different to what you're used to?
No, actually, I think it is all around us. Even in England, to go for a walk on a summer's day, I come back ravished, because this phenomenon called existence, this thing, this body we have been given, implanted with five senses with which we experience the world, it's an astonishing thing to be alive, just to go for a walk along the river and to see how the light falls through the water, how the light dances on a spider's thread stretched across my path. All of that. I am a kind of writer who actually does that. I mean, about D.S. Lawrence, someone said, D.S. Lawrence is a writer very dear to me, said that it's almost as though he was a convalescent. It was someone who had been ill and was looking at the world through now refreshed eyes. Every day he woke up as though... So that is what I feel. And of course, then there is the language question, that what kind of language does one wish to use? And no matter what the subject matter is, the instrument with which I'm dealing with that subject matter is the language in which I am. Say, Cézanne painted tree after tree after tree after tree, not because he was interested in botany, he was interested in color. So whatever this, so The Wasted Vigil is about Afghanistan, but ultimately, at some level, it is about language, you know, because that is, it's a novel. It has to delight someone first and foremost linguistically. Sometimes it is, you want to say things like, she sat down and she wept for a long time. But sometimes it's better to say the tears came so fast she needed two hands to catch them. So, you know.
You're looking for that beautiful poetic metaphor. Let's talk about how you came upon English as a language, if you like,
yes,
and a bit about your background. Naheem Aslant is my guest in conversation at the moment. Nadeem is the author of The Wasted Vigil. Nadeem, you grew up in Pakistan. Can you give me a bit of a sense about your parents? And because their marriage was an arranged marriage.
Arranged marriage, absolutely. And the wonderful thing about arranged marriages is, the wonderful in quotes, is that two completely different backgrounds, two completely different families, and two completely different people can be thrown together. And there is no escape. You have to learn to... So my father's family are quite bohemian. My father is a communist. So there was a great feeling for the life of the mind in my father's side of the family, in that there was music, there were books, magazines were subscribed to, they were coming in every week. I don't come from an affluent background, so we did not have lithographs or paintings or original etchings or what have you. But there were things cut out of magazines but put into frames, like paintings, which were hanging on the walls, in that to convey to everyone in the house that one way of making sense of existence, making sense of life, is to see what others have done this.
So your dad comes from this highly cultured working class
background. My mother's family is totally religious and they are very strict. So their walls would be bare. Music was not allowed. Books were frowned upon because only one book is needed, and that's the Quran. And novels and stories are, in a way, lying. So, and God doesn't approve of lying. So, but you would take that to my father's side of the family and say, but surely a story is a lie. And they would say, yes, but it's a lie that tells the truth.
Do you get stick from your mother's side of the family now for being a professional, internationally regarded liar?
No, yes. I do know that they would rather I wasn't involved in the arts. And these are the things. So I'm so glad that I had both those ways of... I had, from very early on, knowledge of both sides of that existence.
Were there fundamentalists in the family?
Absolutely. One of my uncles, on the very first page of my first novel, there is an uncle who takes a toy from a child and breaks it in half and hands it back, because dolls, masks, toy birds are depictions of living things, and Islam forbids depictions of living things. So children are not allowed to play with dolls or toys and what have you. And I had an uncle like that. So
did your uncle actually do that in front of you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
But he broke a toy in front of you?
Yeah. He took it from me, broke it, and handed it back. And it was a mask. And
that's terrible. Uncle,
no, but here's the thing.
Did you cry? You must have cried.
No, but that happened all the time. So it wasn't, because we would try to listen to music, and they would be turned up because news, because radio was just for news, or the religious programs, you could not listen to songs on that. And that uncle of mine, back in the 1970s, used to go on missionary trips to Europe. And in England, he would stay in a small town in the north called Dewsbury, where a mosque was being founded. And he helped found that mosque. 30 years later, in 2005, in July 2005, some young men from the north of England exploded themselves in the London Underground as a terrorist attack, if you remember, and killing 52 people. And those boys were radicalized in that mosque.
The same mosque your uncle
stayed at. Absolutely, absolutely. So 30 years. So that is how long my involvement with this clash between them, the clash that is taking place, has always taken place within the Islamic world, between militants and the moderates.
So were these, I wonder what that was like for you, Nadeem, with these two strong influences. There's your father who's wants to be intellectually open-minded and culturally engaged in the world, a cosmopolitan, I suppose. Yeah. And there's your mother's side of the family. Were you getting competing pressures growing up?
Well, absolutely. It's just that, and of course, another thing is that I come from quite big families. I have 50 first cousins. So someone asked me the other day, do you know their names? And I said, yes. And then she thought for a while and she says, yes, I suppose it's like my 300 friends on Facebook, that I know all their names and faces. So that's what I suppose an extended family is. Facebook before Facebook was ever thought of. So, yeah, so I very early on, as a novelist, it's a gift that you know there is not one way of being a brother. There isn't one way of being a mother. There isn't one way of being an uncle. There isn't one way of being a human being. That there are at least 50 ways of There are at least 100 ways of being a human being. And Gore Vidal said that the great literature in the 19th century came from very closed societies. He was thinking of Faulkner in the south of, in Southern America.
And
Henry
James, yes.
And he was thinking of Joyce in Ireland. And of course, they are very close-knit families. So when there is a setup like that, you actually, to go back to the point earlier, that you begin to see the nuances between various human beings, that although they are the same family, they are different, and this is the different. So as a novelist, it's a gift to have that very early on.
So Nadeem, your family moved from Pakistan when you were, 15?
Yes, 15.
To Britain. Why? Why did they feel the need to leave Pakistan?
Well, I've written The Wasted Vigil, a novel about Afghanistan, and people keep asking, why Afghanistan? And my life would not have the shape that it has taken if it wasn't for Afghanistan. I said, back in 1979, when the Soviets went in and America decided that we would pour weapons into Afghanistan.
To the Mujahideen,
my father,
and the jihadists, yes.
So my father's family were among the people who said, don't do this. This is wrong. So things were made hard for them. So we had to leave.
This is the time of President Zia, was it?
President Zia, yeah. Absolutely. Here's the interesting thing. Until the Soviets went into Afghanistan, was a pariah, was an internationally hated figure because he had hanged President Bhutto.
He was a dictator and
He was a dictator, he was loathed, he was isolated. The moment the Soviets went in, it was decided, oh God, we need Pakistan, so let's put up with this guy and let's flatter him. Let's give him a blank check and a free rein. He could do anything he wanted in Pakistan. And what we saw on the 3rd of March last week happening in Pakistan when the Sri Lankan cricket team was attacked, the seeds for all of that were sown in the 1980s during the President Zia's regime. And there were people like my father who were saying, don't do this. This is going to blow up in our faces. So things were made. So writers, poets, journalists were either killed or they were thrown out of the country, or they ended up in hospitals. So, or they ended up in graveyards, as I said. So we left. I arrived in England at the age of 14 with very little English.
What do you remember of you arrived at Heathrow?
Heathrow, absolutely, because at that time Manchester did not take international flights, I don't think. It was a very small airport.
Yeah, what do you remember of arriving in England?
Well, you see, people think that there would be a kind of, there must have been a sense of loss, but I was 14. It was an exciting thing. England was a exciting country. So, and I wasn't alone. So had I gone there on my own, of course I would have been torn to pieces by the experience. But I was with my family, and there were new challenges. My aunt was living in Huddersfield, and so we went to Huddersfield from Heathrow, and my father began working as a binman, and I during the summer enrolled myself in an English language, in an English for foreigners program, and I went to high school, and in high school the subjects I did well in were sciences, because for sciences your English needn't be that good, you need to assimilate facts. But the things I was interested in, politics, literature, history, economics, for that you need to write essays, you need to compose paragraphs, and I couldn't write a sentence, let alone a paragraph.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
And this morning my guest in conversation is Nadeem Aslam. Nadeem is Pakistani-born, Britain-based these days, and his latest novel is called The Wasted Vigil. We were just talking before the headlines of your arrival in glorious Huddersfield, beautiful Huddersfield in Yorkshire. What was the social disconnect like for you there? Because there are very large populations there from Pakistan and India. Yeah. Yes. And plenty of Yorkshiremen as well. How did that suit you? How did you find that?
I think it was a very complicated time because, first of all, I was a teenager, so there were certain things were happening which would have happened anyway. My first kiss, my first love, my first sex. So there was that. Secondly, arriving in a country with very little English, doing that, and of course that was the first time in my life I became aware of racism, really. In that racism directed towards me. In that up until I arrived in England, I had taken it for granted that if I met someone, they would like or dislike me based on my qualities, based on my character, based on my behavior. But to go to England and to learn that it was a possibility, that it was a likelihood that when I met someone, he or she could decide immediately, just by looking at me, whether or not they wanted to be with me. That I'm talking about racism here. That is how racism works.
So this is something you directed to you personally, not watching stuff on the telly.
No. Of course, it happened. It was greatly traumatic, I have to say. So it was a difficult time, but it did not last too long in that I had 14 years in Pakistan when, as I said, because of my background, I knew that some of the world's greatest art, some of the world's greatest music, some of the world's greatest leaders, some of the world's greatest books had come from my part of the world. So when someone said to me, you are inferior because of where you come from, my response eventually, I began to see that my response was actually, you don't know what you're talking about. Now, that is different from someone who was actually born in Britain. Had I been born in Britain, it is possible that I could have actually internalized that because I did not have those 14 years to fall back on, thinking that the greatness of my culture, as it were, that India, Pakistan, or Africa, or whoever have valid things to offer the world, as
is,
it were.
Is the test for racism not? Sometimes I think it's how much power there is behind the statement.
Absolutely.
How much where the power lies and
absolutely.
All that.
So it's England has changed. It has to be said. I mean, when I think back, I find it astonishing, and that as recently as the mid 80s, you could hear the word, excuse me using this word, the words nigger and paki on primetime British TV. It's an astonishment. It has changed. These days, it would never happen. Now, I'm a political creature down to the last cell in my body. If a culture changes, if a society changes, if a country changes, it's because there is a will to change it, people want to change it. Things were hard in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Now they are not. Why? Because people stood up and said, look, something needs to be done. That you know, I'm not going to pay the license fee and be insulted in my drawing room. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So people marched, people formed organizations, people protested politically. So if things change, they have to change. You need to do something about them. The passage of time actually on its own is not going to change anything.
Well, this is interesting, Nadine, because in one sense you're, and we'll talk about this in a minute, you're the writer who does withdraw from the world for just about 11 years. Yeah. 11 years!
Well,
and to write a book, one book, but you still believe, nonetheless, in being engaged, not sitting back, not monkish
absolutely
exclusion.
Absolutely not. One of my deepest beliefs is that I do not end where my skin ends. That I am connected by invisible threads to other human beings. That
Man
I have a responsibility.
An island entire of itself.
Absolutely. So when you say that that I isolate myself during the writing of Maps for Lost Lovers, I was in financial difficulties. So what I would do is that I would get for 3 months. I would do menial jobs. I would work on building sites. I would work as a waiter. I would tear up tickets at a cinema. I would work as an usher, and I would save as much of that money as I could. And then during the next 3 months, I would not have to worry about money. And so, because I had earned that money with such a great difficulty, that I wanted to save as much of that I could. I did not want to enjoy myself, as it were. I did not want to spend £3 on a pint of beer, if you know what I'm saying. So I wanted to stay in. So I wanted to remove as many temptations as I could. So I would block out my curtains. I would sleep during the day. I would write at night. So that if I looked out the window and it was a nice day, I might say that, you know, let's go for a walk.
Were you living with your mum and dad at that time?
Oh, no.
On your own?
No, I was on my own, yes, absolutely. Because
were people worried about you, given that you must have disappeared from your social life too?
Absolutely. To my family, I was saying that because by that time, one novel had been accepted. So I went to university to read biochemistry, to quickly go back, because I studied sciences. I went to university to read biochemistry. In my third year, I realized that my English was good enough. So by that time, I had been in England for nearly 9 years. So I wasn't interested in biochemistry. So I wanted to be a writer. So I dropped out and began to write my first novel, which took 11 months to write. And I did not know how to have a book published. I was living in the north. So the writers I loved were V.S. Naipaul, John Updike, who has sadly recently left us, Gore Vidal, Timothy Moore. And they were published by a wonderful firm in London, called On the Deutsch. I picked up one of John Updike's novels, looked at the copyright page, and sent them the manuscript. And 10 days later, I got a phone call saying, we've got the manuscript, come and have lunch. And I said, I can't because I have no money. And they said, we'll pay you money, come and have lunch. So the book was accepted, and then they said, now go and write the second one. And then I told my parents that I actually dropped out of university some months ago, and I didn't tell you, but I have been writing, and here is the novel, and it's going to be published. So I think, and then the book won awards, and I was very frugal with that money as well, because I, as I said, did not go to university to study literature. Now I said, let's educate ourselves. So I'm going to read everything Joyce wrote. I read everything Patrick White wrote. I read everything D.H. Lawrence wrote. Everything. So,
Dima, I have this lovely picture of you in Huddersfield. There you are, as a man born in Pakistan, there in Huddersfield, reading Voss.
Yes, absolutely.
Getting images of Central Australia.
It's a great book.
Flitting across your mind on a rainy day in Huddersfield.
Absolutely. He's a great writer. And the money eventually ran out.
Work.
So that's
more
what
money.
I did.
Because
I couldn't do anything
For
else.
11 years, did you have to stop being social? Did you have to stop seeing friends?
Absolutely. In that, when you go out with friends and you go out for a meal, you have to pick up the tab occasionally. So someone will pay for your meal once, someone will pay for your meal a dozen times, someone would pay for your meals 100 times. But there does come that 101st time when they're saying, dude, what's going on? So I did not want to put anyone in that position.
You didn't want to go out for that 101st meal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And after 11 years, you must reach that point pretty quickly, I suppose.
So when I met... So after I finished the book and it was published, when I connected with my friends again, and they said, where did you go? Because we haven't heard from you for at least 6-7 years. And I said, I was in the next town. And they said, so why not look us up? So I explained it to them that I... And they said, you know, we would have paid for that 101st meal as well. And I said that, yes, but by that time you lot were married, you had kids. I know you. I don't know your husband. I know you. I don't know your wife. He or she might say, you know, who is this guy?
Coming around, getting fed all the time.
Yes,
a free meal.
So
it's still very romantic. It's still a really lovely and romantic, poetic notion that someone should withdraw from the world for 11 years, Nadine.
No. I think I was too young, and I think if something is worth doing, it's worth doing. And one thing I cannot stress enough, a writer, if he or she is any good, at his deepest self, doesn't even have need for publication, let alone approval, good reviews, prizes, or big advances. And I'm not talking, and this isn't someone who is coming out for sour grapes. I have these things, but I know that these things are a byproduct of me trying to write my book. They are not important.
So when are you happy? Are you happy while you're writing, or when you've finished? And you can look at I was asking about to Ian McEwan when he came on Conversations about the satisfaction of putting another volume on the shelf so you see a whole lot of spines stacked up side by side of your work, of your books. You just eventually you want to sort of fill up a shelf and then you die eventually. What makes you happy? Where's the pleasure in this for you, Nadine?
It's a very good question. I think finishing a book and thinking that I did what I set out to do and that I did all I could do and that I am happiest, once again, I saying that I have this deep sense of responsibility to the world I live in. One of my deepest beliefs is that I'm an ordinary human being. There is nothing special about me. So that if something is true of me, it is true of billions of other people. So I go into myself and try to find out what is my truest instinct, what is my truest impulse. And once I have located that and I have pinned it onto the book, onto the page, and that means that when a reader picks it up, he or she would now, it might be slightly easier for them to plummet to that depth themselves and see, this is what I am at my truest self. This is what I am as a human being. These are my responsibilities. These are my loves. These are the things that I don't wish to see in the world. To find that inside me and then put that in this object called the book, which opens at one end, and then have it see go out into the world. It's communication, absolutely.
Nadim Aslam is my guest in Conversation, a British-based author, and his book is called The Wasted Vigil. Nadim, I suppose after September the 11th, it was inevitable, you being a writer in Britain from a Muslim country, that people would be banging on your door wanting you to explain why suddenly the Muslim world apparently hates the West.
Yeah.
Was it like that for you? Were you sort of asking you to explain what the source of this jihadi rage was coming from? And did you have any answers?
Well... As I just explained earlier in the interview, that I was dealing with these subjects long before 9/11. On the first page of my first novel, I dealt with what happens when a child comes face to face with militant Islam.
His toys are absolutely.
So, I have heard any number of writers say that on the morning of 12th of September, they woke up and said that the book I have been writing is worthless compared with this massive subject, these concerns that I have spent the past 2 or 3 years dealing with have been diminished. all I can say is that when I saw the planes go into those buildings and it was discovered that it was Al-Qaeda and what have you, I said, that's my novel on the screen. That was the novel I was writing. That was my first novel. I was, you know, so, but something did happen. Before 9/11, if someone had asked me, are you a Muslim? I would have said, you know, I drink, I don't say my prayers. Sex before marriage is a big yes for me. So perhaps I'm not a Muslim. It's nothing I want to think about. But after 9/11, when someone asks me, are you a Muslim? I say, yes, I am. In that, it has now become important for me to send a message to, for people like me, to send a message to the non-Muslim world saying that not all of us are Al-Qaeda, not all of us are the Taliban, that a Muslim looks like me as well. And that is also a message to Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. It's me saying to them, I refuse to let you be the one who decides what a Muslim is, that the Muslim world contains millions of people who are like me, whether you like it or not. And
that thing I read somewhere in an interview with you where you said you were always frightened of the game of hangman. Can you tell me a bit about that, what you meant by that?
Well, as a human being, it's a, the game of hangman where you have to guess, and every time you guess wrong, the figure actually gets closer and closer to the scaffolding.
New line is drawn, and
and then if you make so many mistakes, you have a person hanging on the scaffolding. And as a child, I was terrified of this. I thought me not knowing the right answer is going to get somebody else hanged, as it were.
And this, when you say not knowing the right answer, this is when this the is world's media is knocking at your door and wanting explanations.
Absolutely,
from you.
That is what I. But in a way, it is a good thing to be in this situation for a writer, because it, a situation like this calls for minds that have to be sharp. You had better be fully knowledgeable. You had better know what you're talking about, because you don't want to give the wrong impression about what the problem might be, what the, why those things happened in Mumbai, why that cricket team was attacked earlier this month. So, so as I said, as a writer, you're trying to do that anyway, as true, as intelligent as you can. But when you know there is that added thing, there is a fear, but there is also, it's an energizing factor as well.
When you went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, as you said, you met some of these people who actually had been at a training camp. And you said, I think you, I don't know if we ever quite got to the end of it, you said you did a first draft of the novel.
Yes.
And put it in your backpack.
Yes.
Before you went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, yeah. So you could then substantially revise it. And you said this was a test for yourself.
Absolutely. It's
Where did you get a tick, and where did you get a cross, Nadeem?
Actually, I have to say that the things that I changed were the minor things, like, oh, I thought the Persian lilac trees would be blossoming in May. They actually blossom in April. So it was that kind of thing.
Rather than the larger issues.
And as I said, I talked to everyone. And one of the interesting things was that up until I crossed into Afghanistan, and that was the only thing that came as a surprise and that I hadn't guessed, was that everyone said America has to get out of Afghanistan. What's it doing there? In England, that's what I heard. In Pakistan, that's what I heard. The moment I crossed into Afghanistan, it was like going through the mirror. It became the general feeling was, this isn't an American country. Americans have to leave, but not yet. If they leave, the Taliban would come back, and we don't want that. This is what everyone said, and every class of person, that is what they said to me. The Taliban too. Are there. They are saying that the Americans have to get out. I know that. But they are a very small minority. It's just thing is that these people have guns. These people have explosives. Their voices are being heard.
Let me ask you then, yesterday I think I heard President Obama saying that the United States may start to look at negotiating with or dealing with the moderate elements of the Taliban, and it made me wonder just how bad the military position is over there if you have to start talking about dealing with moderate elements of the Taliban. What's your understanding? Are there such thing? Is there such a thing as a more moderate element of the Taliban?
Look, Donald Rumsfeld said some years ago about Herat. He said that the governor we have installed in Herat is a good man. We can deal with him. The man is a war criminal, you know. But he has given Donald Rumsfeld the reassurance that he would not attack America. He can do anything he wants to the Afghanis. So this is back to the Zia regime. You know, we need Zia. If he does what we ask him to do, he can do whatever he wishes in Pakistan. So this is what is happening again and again. These things keep being repeated. So what will happen is that they will go to a warlord, say to him, promise us you will not attack the NATO and American and soldiers. We will forget this charge sheet against you. This is... But in a way... But having said that, I can see where that is coming from. I've just finished reading Tony Judd's big book called Post-War about the reconstruction of Europe after Second World War. And all across Europe, we were having to do deals with people who we knew had committed crimes. But this city needs a police force. This city needs an army. We know the army chief is a war criminal. So let's try to remove him and let's get someone else who is not that big a criminal. You know? So...
It's a choice between...
Yes.
Some dreadful choices that have to be made there.
So I'm not saying that it's right. I'm not saying it's right. It's that if you remember that once we made those choices, we had to keep a very close eye on those chaps.
Just finally, I want to ask you about a story you wrote for the New York Times that was reprinted in Australia as well. It's a lovely story. It's a wonderful story. I want you to tell it because it's just so lovely, and it's about food,
yes,
and family,
yes,
and finding people through food. Tell me this experience you had going to a restaurant in London.
Yes, my brother and my sister and I went for an evening meal. And as we were, it was to a Pakistani restaurant. And the food we were having, as we began to eat, we began to think of our aunt, who was dead, who had been dead for more than a decade and who lived in Pakistan.
But is this something you often do when you eat at a restaurant? You say, you wrote in the article, as we always do, searching for our grandmother or our mother,
yes,
or our
aunties.
No. You search for family through food?
Well, as you think, when you take a mouthful of biryani, you think, this biryani is like aunt so-and-so used to make, or this biryani is not as good as my mother makes, or this. So you actually do that because your first link to food is the women in your family. So this is the thing. So whenever the food comes, this is what you think. Is this as good as cousin so-and-so used to make? So this was exactly like our aunt used to make. And the more we ate, the more we remembered that aunt. So we actually called the waiter over and said, who is your cook? Because no way. Because women actually protect their recipes as well. Because if they think that this dish is known as the most beautiful dish of its kind in the entire family, they will not let you know what's in it. Meaning that it is that you should come to her always and say, can you please make me that thing? So it's a way of saying, if you want my love, you know, I am the only person who can
it's
give it.
It's intellectual property. It's the sort of thing that you have in your own books, isn't
culinary
it?
Culinary property, yeah. Absolutely, copyrighted. And so, and he said that the cook is actually a woman. And now, the cooks in these places are always men. And so we were. So my sister got up and went into the kitchen, and from in the kitchen we heard her give out a shout. So me and my brother ran towards the kitchen. And it was my cousin, the daughter of our dead aunt, who had been living in England illegally for so many months. And we actually found her through the taste. And she said that we did not want to let you know because we were quite ashamed of our circumstances, that we had fallen on bad times and we were having to live in our country illegally. And we also thought that you might get into trouble with the police, as it were. So,
so how did that night end then? What happened then?
Well, with reunion. It's so after she finished, we went back to her place, and then her brothers, my male cousins, who were driving taxis at night, they came home at about 3 or 4 o'clock. So we sat and talked, and then she promised to cook us some. There is a delicacy in Pakistan which I understand. There's a tree in Australia called Bohinia tree, which has big pink flowers. You can actually eat the buds of that tree. Oh. And so people actually send them. And I know in Australia, the movement of food is restricted, but between Pakistan and England, it isn't. So you can send food stuff. So people actually send the things that you can't find in England. One of the things that is sent is the flower buds of the Bohinia tree from Pakistan. And someone had brought some over for my cousin from Pakistan in a small plastic bag. And she said, when you come and see me tomorrow and I will cook those for you.
Oh, that's just beautiful in every way, that story, Nadeem. And it's sort of characteristic of your writing in a strange way too. Nadeem, it's been wonderful meeting you. Thank you so much for being with me in conversation today.
Thank you very much for allowing me to talk.
It's Nadeem Aslam, and his book is called The Wasted Vigil.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.